This is Don Hussig with Cancer Action Network. You're listening to Loving the Earth, Pollution-Free Revolution. Today we're continuing our theme of stopping tar sands, and we have Josh Porter on the phone with us. In fact, I have to re-speak that. Zach Porter. Sorry about that, Zach. I'm sure you don't get called Josh very often. That's a long way from Zach. I really apologize. We have Zach Porter on the phone with us. He is a representative of a group called All Against the Hall. Tell us about All Against the Hall.
Sure. All Against the Hall has grown out of a real grassroots effort in Montana, Idaho, Washington, and Oregon to oppose the construction or establishment of a permanent industrial corridor to the Alberta tar sands along some of our nation's most spectacular highways and byways through the Pacific Northwest and Northern Rockies and through numerous communities along a 1,000-mile stretch of roadway from Lewiston, Idaho, to northern Alberta, 500 miles in the United States. And really, All Against the Hall was formed in the summer of 2010 to elevate a lot of excellent work that had already been done by grassroots groups based throughout this region beginning in late winter of 2010, which was when the public really first learned about this proposal. And of course, I'll explain more about that proposal. But you know, All Against the Hall is uniting efforts across the four-state region, coordinating communication between the upwards of 50 organizations that are working on this right now and businesses that have an interest as well, doing on-the-ground grassroots organizing across the region, putting pressure on elected and appointed officials, and contributing to a legal effort to make sure that this corridor doesn't get established.
Sounds like a great project and a lot of really good work. What is the, you know, what is the hall? You know, what's the proposal?
Sure. At its simplest, the hall is the shipment of foreign-made, in this case, South Korean and Japanese-made specialized pieces of equipment that could have been made here in North America, either in Canada or the United States, but due to cost concerns by, in this case, the corporations ExxonMobil and their Canadian subsidiary Imperial Oil, they're 70% owned by ExxonMobil, as well as ConocoPhillips and Harvest Energy Corporation, a South Korean national oil company, as well as others that we are sure are to follow suit. They have proposed shipping this Asian-made equipment up the Columbia and Snake Rivers by way of barge transport using a network of locks and dams that allow barges to take loads from ocean-going vessels 500 miles upriver to the port of Lewiston, Idaho. It's actually the farthest most inland port on the west coast of the United States. From that point, they load this equipment onto trucks that are about three stories high, three stories wide, and upwards of 220 feet long, and 650,000 pounds. So that's more heavier than the Statue of Liberty, and about three-quarters of the length of a football field. And they'll take those loads up roads that are among our country's most popular and scenic destinations along one of only 30 all-American roads in the United States, the Locksaw River Corridor along U.S. Highway 12, Wild and Scenic River Corridor, as well as up Montana's Big Blackfoot River, which was made famous by the book and movie A River Runs Through It. And then on up the Rocky Mountain Front is what we call it here in Montana, where the Rockies meet the plains, and on into Alberta. So it traverses some magnificent landscapes and passes through dozens of communities along the way, and poses a threat not only to our environment along the route with the risk of these trucks falling into the rivers, as well as numerous modifications to these narrow, winding, mountain, rural roads to make this haul all possible, but also to our heavily tourism and recreation-based economy here in Idaho and Montana, which will suffer an enormous hit if we establish this permanent corridor to the tar sands, where literally hundreds of these loads will be going through, if not thousands, in the next decade or more. And so we're facing a pretty game-changing situation here. And that's the haul, I guess, at its simplest.
Yes. It's good to see that your people have been so wise to recognize that it isn't just this first proposal. You know, considering the absolute incredible magnitude of the tar sands exploitation and their predictions of how quickly that is going to grow and grow and become a larger and larger activity going on there in Alberta, and then these proposals to also do tar sands in Saskatchewan. It does, I'm sure you're totally right in making this big effort to stop this, thinking of it as a much more harmful matter than, you know, just say this one first proposal, because it all rings true. It just makes a lot of sense what you guys are thinking, and I'm sure you're right about it. So tell me, what, it doesn't sound like these are the right roads for this. It just, you know, small, I'm sure they're not suicidal, and these people aren't, you know, they're not super crazy. How are they going to get those loads up some of these small roads? It means a lot of reconstruction. Are they going to change grades? Are they, you know, what are they going to do? Can they take those kind of loads up through the Rockies? And, you know, they're not going to do this in the wintertime, are they?
They will be doing it in the wintertime. They'll do it year-round. And they claim it can be done, but we claim otherwise. There are places along these roads where the trucks will have literally just inches of clearance between rock walls on either side, or between you know, the edge of the road and a river. So it bewilders us how they're going to accomplish this too, and to move these loads in the time frame that is allotted by state regulations in Idaho and Montana. Where, for example, you know, most states have laws saying, you know, transport of, you know, any load on a state highway can't delay the public, you know, public traffic more than, you know, 10 or 15 minutes is a pretty standard rule. And the same goes for Idaho and Montana, 15 minutes in Idaho, 10 minutes in Montana. In order for these loads to accomplish that between the places that they have available to turn out, they would have to drive these loads at upwards of 50 miles an hour, and we're talking about roads that, you know, have corners on a regular basis where you're warned to go down to 25, 35 miles an hour. And again, these are 650,000-pound loads that are 220 feet long. And so it's hard to imagine a truck like that traveling an average speed of anywhere from 30 to 50 miles an hour in order to get between turnouts. You know, it boggles us, and we don't think it's possible.
Well, tell me, so, is it so wide? Are the trucks wide enough that most places it wouldn't be possible to have the other lane of traffic, you know, proceeding along past them, you know, just passing them, you know, going along the opposite direction?
That's correct. I mean, these are two-lane highways the entire way, almost entirely. I should clarify, there are very few portions where there are four lanes, two lanes in both directions. Really, just in a couple of communities along the route is there the ability for folks to pass like that. More often, there will be long stretches, again, you know, due to the constraints of moving something like this up these roads, long stretches of 45 minutes or more where the public will have to wait to allow one of these trucks to pull over to get around them. So it could be, in some cases, a life-threatening situation. We work with people along this entire route, and we hear stories about early morning trips to the emergency room, in some cases down the only road in or out from these communities, that would not have been possible if there had been an obstruction in the road like this. And there really is no way to get around these things. So it presents a serious threat to residents of these rural communities, as well as to people who enjoy them for recreation. The trucks will be parked in turnouts, blocking access to favorite fishing sites, hiking, trailheads, places to head off hunting, you name it. So the issues are multifaceted, and there's really 101 reasons to be against these things.
Yeah, I think so. One of them that comes to my mind as we're talking here, are they going to use a different type of tractor to, you know, to haul that? It seems like so much more huge a load. I don't see how a normal, you know, diesel engine, you know, in just one truck could do that. I'm just thinking to be behind that must be a large amount of diesel exhaust being put out to move something that mega a load, you know.
You know, these are specialized trucks that will be hauling the equipment. I couldn't say for certain, what the specs are for the tractor trailer trucks that will be pulling this kind of equipment. I think that they're just kind of slightly larger than what you would see on a normal highway in terms of the cab of the truck. It doesn't look anything different than that, though. This isn't a piece of equipment that you haven't seen. The truck itself isn't anything that the normal average American hasn't seen before on the road. It's probably a little bit larger than what you'd see pulling an 18-wheeler. But the what's so much larger is the fact that there will be not only a pull truck but a push truck, and in some cases there will be two trucks on either end in order to get these loads over two mountain passes, Lolo Pass on the Montana-Idaho border, and then the Continental Divide in Montana. There is significant climbing and then descending that has to happen. And in order to both pull them up over the pass and guide them slowly down the other side, they'll have to have multiple, push and pull trucks to help.
Have they done a test run, any test runs this? You know, have they ever proven it can be done?
You know, there was a test run that I think was done earlier this summer with a much smaller load. So it didn't weigh the same, I don't even know if the dimensions were exactly the same. But there was a run made earlier this summer, and I don't know if anyone knows the results of that. It was kept relatively quiet. As far as we know, there have never even been any trucks of this size on roads in Idaho or Montana in history. So this would be setting a new precedent.
Do you get a lot of trucking out there, say, just traditional, just the normal, do you have a bunch of logging trucks? Is it like, is it going to be this all of a sudden trucks when there never were trucks before, or how does that shake out?
No. I mean, Missoula, where I live in Montana, I'm sure much like communities where you are in New York, and other parts of the Northeast, we're a former logging center here, and logging trucks are commonplace on the roads, less than they used to be, but still commonplace, and plenty of interstate truck traffic and other highways in the area. So we're perfectly used to normal truck traffic, and all of us at All Against the Haul and other folks in this campaign have no issue with the trucks that we normally come across on roads. And
yep.
For that matter, there has been an increase lately in oversized truck traffic on Montana highways. But nothing comes close to comparing to what is proposed to be sent up our roads by Exxon and by Conoco and other corporations. So it's really apples and oranges. You can't really compare them.
I see what you're saying. Tell me this. As far as when would you say, just to ballpark it, when would you say the public, well, let's go back even beyond that. When was the proposal? What was the date of the proposal? When did it start? When did they first start saying, we're going to do this?
They first, it goes back to at least early 2009 for Montana and 2008 or 2007 for Idaho, when the state departments of transportation in both of those states learned about this proposal. The director of transportation in Montana made his first public presentation on the matter in July of 2009. But the governor of Idaho essentially endorsed the project back in January of 2009. The public presentation, I'll make clear, though, that the Department of Transportation head in Montana made was to a committee of senators here in the state, and not, you know, it was not something the public would have been following closely or normally heard about. And it really wasn't until March of 2010, late March, early April, that the public first got an inkling of what was proposed here, when the first part of a mandated public review process in Montana was completed. We have what's called the Montana Environmental Policy Act, which many states, about 25 states, have environmental policy acts of their own that are modeled after the National Environmental Policy Act, and it, we're the same here in Montana, and we completed what's called an environmental assessment at that time in late winter. And that draft environmental assessment went out for the public to comment on. And there were three hearings held in Montana, all along the route, including one in Missoula, where we're based out of. And, you know, but at the same time, Idaho lacks the equivalent of the Montana Environmental Policy Act or any act like that, and never had public hearings until later this summer. And even then, they were not opportunities for the public to go on record. They were simply chances for the public to learn and to share a few thoughts, but it was not a way for the public really to weigh in on this project with any substance. So, you know, in Montana, there has been the chance for some significant public involvement up to this date, but it's been lacking in Idaho. And so folks in that state are who we work with closely are doing everything they can to make sure that the public has a chance to weigh in before permits are issued.
Yep. So there is this matter. There will eventually need to be permits issued by Montana and Idaho before this actually, you know, is actually done?
That's correct.
Okay. What do you think the likelihood of that is? You know, is it looking good, looking bad? You know, you guys must have some kind of feel for how it's going.
Well, you know, I have to say that when I became involved in this, before All Against the Hall was founded, I was a volunteer working with a group here in Montana called the No Shipments Network, and we formed just a volunteer group to represent the interests of concerned citizens across this part of Montana regarding this proposal. And when we first came together, I don't think any one of us could say that we were feeling confident in our ability to put a dent in this plan. Clearly, this plan has been in the works for years, much longer even than Idaho and Montana's Departments of Transportation have known about it. I'm sure Exxon and Conoco started hatching this plan maybe even a decade back with the amount of planning that has gone into all of this. So, you know, I think we were all feeling the odds are pretty stacked against us. But, you know, at this point in the campaign, it's hard for me to feel anything but confident because from a point of feeling like there was no chance in the world, we're at a place now where I can say with confidence that we have caused significant problems in the plans made by Exxon and Conoco, and will be, you know, already running an effective coordinated campaign across these four states, and will continue to be. Legal challenges in Idaho have slowed down the permitting process in that state far more than anyone would have ever expected. And if permits are issued for these loads, then you know, in Idaho, then it'll enter our court in Montana, and the laws are actually even stronger here to help us challenge in court the proposals. And just to go back a bit more to clarify, what's proposed right now are two different series of shipments. There are four loads proposed by ConocoPhillips headed for a Billings, Montana refinery. They would be the first to use this route. There are also 207 loads proposed by ExxonMobil to travel from Lewis and Idaho. They both originate in the same location, and in this case, the Exxon loads head up to northern Alberta. and then 40 to 60 loads proposed by Harvest Energy Corporation. And that proposal is very early in its stages of progression, and no review has gone on for that one. So at this point, what we're dealing mostly with are the Conoco and Exxon loads, and Idaho is poised to issue permits for the Conoco loads within the next few weeks, potentially opening up this corridor and setting a precedent. But Exxon is less likely to get their loads on the road anytime too soon. For one, their permits are a little farther off from being issued, and for another, they require more road modifications to be done before they roll. So it's unlikely that those could be done in the immediate future with winter upon us here already and snow on the road. But, you know, we've been able to put a massive, roadblock on their plans to this date, and I think we'll be able to continue to do that into the future.
Have any of the road modifications been conducted? Has any of that work actually been done to date?
The only work that has been done to date in Montana has been utility line modifications. In order to let these loads go through, power lines have to be raised and or buried along much of the route. That work has largely been done. There's still some that hasn't been done, but much of it has been. The road work in this state, which entails building over 50 new turnouts along narrow river roads and other roads between the Idaho and Alberta border, have yet to happen. However, in Idaho, road modifications have already occurred in many cases. There is some left to be done, but a lot of that work happened under the radar actually 2 years ago in the summer of 2008-2009. So they're farther along in the road preparation process than Montana is. But much of the work here in the state, again, hasn't been done yet. Signs have not been raised permanently or put onto special posts that swivel to allow these loads to go by. Traffic lights, same thing.
Wow.
So there's still a lot of work that needs to happen.
Wow, just and this is out of the blue. I had not heard anything about this. I contacted Jill Pittman with this Keepers of the Athabasca Watershed group out in Alberta, because I forget how I got wind of their group. We've been trying to stop tar sands since I'd say the spring of 2009. You know, that was when we started deciding to take action on stopping this. And eventually I came across this Athabasca Water group, talked to Jill Pittman, and she said to me, she said, well, there's these other issues. It is not just, you know, the activity right here in Alberta. There's this matter of these pipelines and these roads. And that's when she provided me your group's contact information, the All Against the Hall, and there's some other groups, too, that are trying to take these different approaches. And I just want to get a little of our approach in here. We're right at the kind of the worst place you could ever be for the pollution that comes from the Great Lakes Basin. We're on the St. Lawrence River. St. Lawrence County is in upstate New York, you know, right on the border with Canada. The port of Ogdensburg, New York, is approximately 60 miles, you know, 45 minutes on a four-lane up to Ottawa. So we're very close to the developed part of Canada. And we're, just by the way our state is shaped, being northerly compared to a lot of the rest of the U.S., we're just right in that air pollution impact zone from the Great Lakes activities and this whole, that Golden Triangle area down in the Toronto area where there's so much heavily industrialized parts of Canada.
Sure.
And we've been looking at this air toxics data for the Great Lakes Basin for years, for a long time. You know, it's clear that we had a problem with benzene and metals and particulates and, you know, considerable amount of air pollution coming our way. And we keep thinking, why do we have high cancer rates? And we keep thinking it's because of this air pollution. And we just gradually kind of strengthened our position on that, and it's become ever more, you know, solid argument based on the science. So we feel that our part in this, you know, the reason that we are so It's twofold. I certainly believe that the activity out there in Alberta is the most awful thing that anybody ever did to the face of the earth. And for that reason alone, it should be stopped. Then you got the greenhouse gases issue, and that for that reason alone, it should be stopped. But then you got, on top of all that, our high cancer rates here in New York State. And because we're downwind from so much going on with air pollution in the Great Lakes Basin, you know, say these refineries in Sarnia, refinery in Whiting, Indiana, refinery in Toledo, and that's not really even Great Lakes that much. But anyways, we got all these pollution sources and all these huge coal-burning power plants out in the Ohio River Valley and in West Virginia. We are being hammered by air pollution, and to think that anyone would propose to expand these refineries, which is happening, you know, the Whiting, Indiana BP facility is in the process of expanding, and they're claiming they're not going to put out any more pollution than they were before, which is just a lie, you know, just absolute false. You know, they're just making these things up as they go along to try to get away with it, because they know people don't want to get more cancer around here. So this is our, you know, we want to fight tar sands where they exist there in Alberta, but we also want to fight them here in New York State, because we don't need the air pollution that's going to result from refining dirty tar sands crude here in the Great Lakes Basin. And that's what the plan is. You know, much of the refining is intended to take place here in the Great Lakes.
Yeah. Well, and you know, and just so you know, the route that was selected through Idaho, Montana was selected because it presents the shortest route between these Asian manufacturers, cheap sources of labor, and the tar sands, with no overpasses over these roads to make bringing these things through complicated and costly for them. That's why they chose such a rural route. But in fact, several routes already exist, and one of those routes involves taking this equipment up the St. Lawrence River and through the Great Lakes, to Duluth, Minnesota, or to Thunder Bay, Ontario, where the loads are unloaded and stuck onto trains in most cases, or trucks, and then brought up to the tar sands that way. So, in fact, one of the, you know, the other most likely alternative is a route that has been used between the Pacific Ocean and the Gulf of Mexico through the Panama Canal, and then putting equipment onto trucks and trains at the port of Galveston, Texas, near Houston. So, in fact, we share something in common with you there in northern New York. I mean, there are transportation routes for this equipment that could come right through your backyard, and I'm sure already are.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised at all. They got it there somehow. They've got a huge amount of equipment
yep.
up there. And, you know, who's watching? You know, I have no idea. I couldn't say whether some huge excavators or some huge trucks or some cokers or whatever went up the St. Lawrence River. I wouldn't be surprised at all that had taken place sometime in the past. It's been going on so long. What really shocks me about this is that the tar sands, they truly began in the 1960s, for sure. They were really getting going in the 60s. And I'm thinking, wow, I was just, 10 years old in the 60s, you know. I mean, not even 10 in the start of them. But, you know, young person, never heard of it. Then I went to college, never heard of it. Then I was, you know, years after college, never heard of it. I first heard of tar sands as, you know, an environmental issue in the fall of 2008, because I was going to travel and live out in Saskatchewan for a while, and this media person I knew, a news director at a radio station, a public radio station, he said, well, you better look into these tar sands when you're out there, because this is starting to be talked about here. It took that long for the media even to start hearing about the tar sands activity, because there's a Monk Center for International Studies, I believe it's at Toronto University, and this news director had one of his reporters dealing with this presentation on tar sands that was being made at the Monk Center. And it's just horrid, awful, amazing that people are so, I guess, maybe overwhelmed by other environmental problems. You know, we're dealing with all kinds of environmental problems up here in New York State. This trash burning, reindustrialization of the St. Lawrence River Valley, big factory proposals, you know, that we hated and brought lawsuits against and spent a lot of time fighting. This whole matter of using science to prevent cancer, trying to get the public health departments to see it that way. Yeah, but they don't want to tell people that pollution causes cancer. They don't want to give the public these messages that exist in the existing science. So we're just fighting and all that kind of stuff. And then we, you know, come to see that all our fighting here maybe they'll be, you know, kind of very much made seem small if you add on all this pollution from this refining of tar sands in the Great Lakes Basin. So it does kind of give you a moment's pause every once in a while to think about some of these big pictures that I'm totally unaware of. It was like I didn't know the word tar sand or the phrase tar sand had never crossed my ears, you know, become it was never in my brain, you know, never think about it. All those decades of living here, you know, and truly it's not that far away. It's just another country. It's just I've been out through Alberta and didn't know what was going on. So I think one big thing that we got to learn from this is to somehow get better media. We've come to be just very displeased with our news media. If you're getting good results with your news media out there, honor to them, you're fortunate. We have the corporate news media around here, whether it's a public radio station or a, you know, a CBS or a NBC or whatever radio station or a TV station or a newspaper. It's just this matter of giving commerce top priority. You know, if this was happening in New York State, believe me, there'd be plenty of newspapers that were, you know, rallying the business people to support this right to the max. And you know, it's the kind of experiences we have with the media. And I'm sure the reason I've tried to get the media in the Great Lakes Basin to deal with some of these developments in tar sands, and they won't touch it. They don't want to hear about it. You can't even get them to deal with, you know, the pollution that's coming from factories that are right here, going strong, right in the middle of this, you know, this place that's had so much cancer and so much pollution, let alone deal with, they think of that as like this issue on the other side of the earth, you know.
Unfortunately. Sure. Well, you know, and as awful as it is, what might work in our favor is this network of pipelines that they are hoping to construct. Hopefully we'll put an end to those, obviously, but, you know, before long, tar sands oil will be flowing to all corners of the United States, and in conjunction with the, you know, extreme levels of natural gas development going on also in, you know, the Pennsylvania and New York right now and projected to occur into the future with the threats from fracking and you know, other forms of getting at that gas. I think that it will only become more and more apparent to the public what the threats of this fossil fuel development is on all of us. So, you know, I hope it doesn't take so long that we have to live through another disaster to learn our lesson, especially after having already lived through the BP oil spill and
yep.
and things like Love Canal and you know, countless other disasters. But, you know, there are more disasters on their way, and we'll, you know, get another chance to learn from those if we're not careful now. So.
Well, tell me about your experiences. What have been the experiences of All Against the Hall with the news media, you know, the newspapers, the radios, the TV stations in the state of Montana?
Well, we've been fortunate to have extensive coverage, in fact, in local newspapers here about this issue. The Hall issue has graced the front page more times than I can count in the last 6 months. And, you know, it's a significant project that's been proposed for our neck of the woods here. And it, I think it's captured the attention of citizens and generated lots of comments and letters to the editor, op-eds, mostly in opposition to those loads. But, you know, we've been helped by the media in our case, I'd say more than not. We have, you know, reached out to national media outlets and have been able to garner coverage in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal with one article
cool.
in each paper. And so we're doing our best. I think that, you know, we try to take advantage of the fact that some of the landscapes these trucks will pass through really are on the national radar, and we're just lucky to be able to say that here. And that's not to say anything less of any of the other places in the United States that are suffering from similar threats. But we try to, you know, make sure that we play that up and make use of local authors who are also concerned about this issue. For example, authors Rick Bass and David James Duncan, who some listeners might recognize the names of, two prolific nature writers, both of whom live in the Missoula area, are writing, co-authoring a book called Heart of the Monster, which is named after a Nez Perce, which is a tribe here in Idaho, Nez Perce creation story. And the book kind of goes through the ins and outs of the Heavy Hall proposal and the effects of the tar sands on the United States and on the globe. And it's just going to be an amazing book. It's coming out at the end of this month, and listeners can find it online. But again, it's called Heart of the Monster. But we're doing our best to recruit people like that and other people who might have some name recognition to, participate in the campaign and help us spread the word.
Well, it sounds like you're doing a great job, and I'm sure the huge difference between your work there and our work here is numbers of people. Because of the nature of your proposal, you have this thing that's galvanized public, and the public is kind of jumping on this and getting all excited. Here, with just this matter, well, say, for example, the industrial project we opposed. We're a small group, Cancer Action New York, started in January 2000 with about 16 people, and we got small real fast because we decided to do the most critical work that we could do, which was stop this big factory from being constructed. And we did stop them, but we were blackballed. We were, attacked over and over again by the media and the, some of the powerful people in the communities. And, our membership just went down and down. And right now, it's me, one cancer victim, and this guy's 83 years old, and he's got one leg. And we go to, meetings, and we try to bring change. But see, we don't have the numbers of people like you guys have. So the media, seeing that and seeing that the power lies in the, the court of the industrial and the powerful and the big money, they're on their team rather than on. I think the media is kind of a fence sitter. They go wherever the greatest amount of kind of public human energy is. And right now the human energy is on your side out there in Montana, and the human energy is definitely not on our side here in New York State. And in New York isn't, believe me, New York is not as quick to honor the earth as you guys are. New York is not as quick to criticize the rich and powerful, the corporations, as Montana is. And New York, a lot of people are sick here, and they don't have the kind of like the human energy to devote to fighting these things. It's truly a place that's not sweet for being, on an environmental issue. Not yet, anyways. We're hoping, or there's always hope that that'll change.
But sure, just to be clear, it can be an uphill battle here too, and my best advice is simply networking with people who you wouldn't otherwise expect to see working on a campaign with you. We've done everything we can to work closely with tribes across the region that will be impacted, as well as labor unions and folks from the Tea Party
How is the Tea Party helping you guys?
Well, this is an issue that is nonpartisan, in every sense of the word. This is a project that is an affront to our communities and our ways of life here in Idaho and Montana, and it doesn't really matter if you're a liberal or a conservative. This is something that matters to you. So, we don't discriminate. We work closely with anyone who, will suffer the impacts of this proposal. So, I think that politicians and the media alike take notice when unlikely coalitions are formed. So that's something that we've done everything we can to take advantage of out here.
Are you finding that your local politicians are beginning to get on your wagon, join into your tribe? Are they starting to come forward and saying we oppose this?
They are. We have been bolstered by huge support from our city, not only our city council here in Missoula, which is the county seat of Missoula County, but also the county commissioners have also taken a stance of opposition to this proposal. So,
well, that's cool.
We're starting at the lower level here and building our way up, and there are state representatives and senators who oppose these rigs as well, and we're, you know, leveraging their opposition to help us, you know, demonstrate sufficient opposition to our federal, you know, congressional delegation that we can convince them to push for as much review as possible of this project. So working on our senators, Max Baucus and John Tester in Washington, D.C., and others. So politicians are taking notice of this. And, again, it's galvanized, you know, such a broad swath of the population that it's hard for them not to take notice. And so we're hoping that that pressure will play out in our favor before long.
I think you're really onto something here, this matter of as the tar sands grow, and say like this road proposal in this hall, as the pipelines are proposed and constructed and more people just have it touch their life in this real, this very concrete, real kind of way, that there will be a growing umbrella of resistance to tar sands. Do you think, you know, say your problem, you know, this hall, it gets shot down, you know, it's say within like, you know, a year from now, nobody's talking about it anymore, it's dead, you know, it's not going to go anywhere. Do you believe that the people, a significant fraction of the people that have become aware of tar sands now? Because I'm thinking that probably a lot of people out there had never heard of tar sands, right? Wasn't tar sands like a new issue for Montana before this came along?
Oh, yeah. No, just as with you and with, you know, most, I would say, probably other Americans, the tar sands are still a big unknown. And so as awful as this proposal is for Idaho, Montana, Washington, and Oregon, and we haven't even begun to touch on all of the different impacts around here, you know, this issue will serve as an excellent educational tool for people. And we are using it that way and have been able to, you know, educate thousands of people already, I'm sure, on what the tar sands are and their relative impact, you know, in comparison to more conventional sources of oil versus, you know, completely clean energy sources as well. So I think that, you know, as always with these kinds of things, there are maybe, if you, you know, really try to look at it this way, some good things that could come out of it, and just
yep.
in that we've been able to educate, you know, many people who wouldn't have known about the devastation being wrought in northern Alberta, not only on the boreal forests and wildlife up there, but also, you know, almost much more importantly on communities located up there and people who are suffering from, you know, hugely elevated cancer rates. So, and, you know, we are facing tar sands development in the United States before long here. Utah already has its first permitted tar sands mine, which would be the first in the United States. And there are tar sands underneath other states as well, as far as I know, including Montana. So this could be something that we're dealing with much closer to home here before long. And any education that we can do now will serve us well in the future.
Yeah, yeah. So tell me, do you think that some of your people, some of the people that have come together and become activists and, you know, are working on stopping an environmental threat, are they going to be stop tar sands people regardless of how this particular fight turns out?
Oh, I think so. I mean, I can't speak for everyone, of course, but I think that, you know, more and more Americans and more Montanans and Idahoans, et cetera, are, you know, becoming cognizant of what's going on up there. And you know, I think as they appreciate more and more the dangers of tar sands development, period, whether or not it's coming right through your backyard like this heavy haul is, I think people are looking at it as something that just doesn't benefit any of us. So, I think we are bringing more and more people into our ranks just based on tar sands issue alone, outside of the heavy haul.
Yeah, I wouldn't be surprised. Do you find that it's the case that, say, you're dealing with this particular issue, And then when you expand it to the whole tar sands story, that, you know, people are even all the more quick to say, well, you know, we're concerned about this heavy haul, but if it's going to be for the purpose of doing tar sands, we're even more opposed to it than we would have been if it was just something, you know, relatively acceptable, getting hauled, you know, in a big way, you know. Is the fact that tar sands really clinching it for you guys?
You know, I think it all depends on the person. And to us at All Against the Haul, you know, to be in all honesty, it matters less to me what it is that motivates them to oppose these trucks than that they oppose them in the first place. And,
yep.
You know, as you can imagine, that's just the campaign that we're running here. But, you know, for some people, the tar sand sends them over the edge and is, you know, anything related to the tar sands is something that they would oppose. To other people, you know, they're just like in, you know, anywhere else, there are plenty of people here who just don't think it's their business to be meddling in what's going on up there, but are concerned about the local impacts. And, you know, it all helps us in the end. So I don't try to push any one viewpoint on anyone, but we do, you know, educate folks on the impacts of the tar sands, as well as just the impacts of this permanent corridor. So
well, that's cool.
It's all based on the person.
Yeah. Tell me, how far are you guys willing to go? You know, how far will Montana residents go to stop this trucking?
We'll go all the way. We're in this for the long haul. You know, I personally, and for anyone else in this campaign, we just can't imagine this corridor being anything other than what it is now, which is just an incredibly scenic and economically important mainstay for this region. And, you know, this would be a much different place if every day a load of this type was rumbling through town, and we're just not willing to face that future. So we will take this until we have absolutely no recourse any longer.
Are barricades on the highways a recourse?
I can't speak for people who will be planning those things, but from talking to plenty of individuals around the region about this issue, I have heard grandmothers, I have heard, college students, I've heard, people involved in business of all kinds around this region saying to me that they'll be the first one to lie down in the road in front of one of these trucks if they come through. And I can guarantee for whomever is planning these shipments that they will meet resistance, physical resistance, if they're not stopped in other ways. I can't speak to any of that, but that's just the truth of it at this point, and that's what I've heard for months now, as I've kind of taken a gauge of community opposition to these loads. So that is in the future, if these loads come through.
It's good to know that the "don't tread on me" attitude is alive and well in the American West. You know, that's cool. We like to think it's alive and well here too, and you know, we do. We feel that enough is enough. There should not be the amount of industrial activity going on in our country. It shouldn't get worse. There needs to be an accounting for how much harm has been caused by all the pollution. And something done about that, meaning a true revolution as far as how industrial activity is carried out and how people's lives are affected by it and what kind of changes come about. And so we oftentimes say, when it seems like things are just stacked against us and that the overlords just are intent upon doing as they damn well please, regardless of how much pain and suffering is caused by it, we say to them, viva the revolution. And we mean it. I mean it right from the depth of my heart and my toenails in the, you know, the ground. I mean it. I'm not going to be, you know, stepping back on any of these things. It's too important. This is a special time, and I think the time is upon us to stand firm on resisting these industrial changes that are making things worse, far worse than anybody. It's unacceptable. It's absolutely unacceptable.
Yeah.
Well, so very nice talking with you, Zach. And I wish you the best of luck. I'm sure you guys will need it a few times, but maybe you won't need a whole lot of it considering, you know, how many people are joining together. That's the key. The key is the numbers. That's what all the politicians care about because they're just into getting votes. What's all the business people care about because they're not into having a whole bunch of people, you know, standing out in the street screaming their name. And so, yeah, I'm thinking you guys are going to have some good success out there. So maybe we should be turning our eye to the St. Lawrence River Seaway and the Seaway and all that and wondering what's coming down our through our waterways here.
Well, please do take a look out and let us know if you learn of anything passing through that way. And
maybe we'll do a Google search, St. Lawrence River megaloads, or say St. Lawrence River tar sand load, or, you know, and who knows what we might come across. Never know.
Sure, no, and please, you know, to anyone who listens in on this, visit our website, allagainstthehall.org,
okay.
And you can learn anything that you could possibly want to learn about the hall and about the tar sands as well, and get in touch with any of us here.
Yeah, when I was on your website, it's very impressive. You got a lot of good information there. There's another group. There's several other groups. I'm thinking there's a neat video. Is that video that Holly Schroeder made, is that video on your website, or is how do people get, you know, come across that?
It is on our website, yep. If you go to the page on our site called The Hall, then you can click on the link to videos at the bottom left. You'll see a column on the left-hand side of the page that says videos. Click on that, and that video will pop right up. And that's a great introduction, 8-minute video that you can share with friends through YouTube. So, yeah, please check it out.
Yeah, it's going to be – it's the YouTube and the videos are a powerful part of bringing these changes. Anybody got plans on making a movie about this?
You know, I've actually come across a few people who are trying to make documentaries about what's going on here, and I don't know what will pan out in the end, but there's definitely interest. So there might be something coming out after all. This is, you know, quite a camp. I think it's going to be over anytime too soon. So it would be an epic movie if it ever does come out.
Well, it sounds like there's a lot of really good vibe out there. And it's been great talking to you, Zach. I hope you guys have a great solstice. You know, we're not far from the solstice now. And there's a lot of power in that, you know, this time of darkness when people get all excited about lights. You know, maybe that will be another big step, you know, some of the good vibe from the solstice and moving forward on stopping this.
Sure, maybe so, yeah. And thanks to you for having us on your show.
Well, we love people that are all about stopping the tar sands. So honor to All Against the Hall and Zach Porter.
Great. Well, thank you. Yeah, take care.
Yeah, bye.